Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Southwest Airlines has those ads on TV. You've seen them, right?
You are now free to move about the country.
Well, the airline itself is moving about the country, too. A multi-billion dollar merger for the discount carrier today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by PBS, presenting Baseball, the 10th Inning from Ken Burns, premieres Tuesday, September 28th at 8, 7 Central on most PBS stations.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, everybody, the 27th of September, and it is good, as always, to have you here. The ticker symbol for Southwest Airlines is LUV, L-U-V. It's a tribute to its original home base of Love Field down in Dallas, Texas. But the carrier has been getting a huge amount of consumer love, too. It has more domestic passengers than any other airline in this country. It's been profitable for years now in the face of brutal aviation competition. So you have to ask why it's going to spend $1.4 billion to buy its low-cost rival, AirTran. Marketplace's Eve Tro has the story.
In its announcement about AirTran, Southwest says, quote, both companies have dedicated people with kindred warrior spirits, unquote. They are both no-frills, low-cost carriers, but Southwest isn't buying AirTran because they're so kindred. This powwow is about Southwest adding big names to its Where We Fly list, like Atlanta, Georgia, and Reagan Airport in Washington, D.C.
Southwest becomes more appealing to people who live in those cities, as well as business travelers destined for those markets, which is the key to any airline's profitability.
That's Henry Hardeveld with Forrester Research. He says Southwest avoided these airports because they were known for delays. But now, overall air traffic is down, and Southwest feels it can keep up its level of service. But Hardeveld says the AirTran purchase will still complicate Southwest's motto of keep it simple.
They have to evolve from keep it simple to keep it simpler.
A few of the wrinkles? AirTran charges baggage fees. Southwest doesn't. How will it make up the revenue? AirTran has business class and assigned seating. Southwest notoriously doesn't. It has to phase them out. Plus, AirTran flies to Aruba and the Bahamas. Southwest only flies within the continental U.S. George Hobica leads airfarewatchdog.com. He says Southwest likely welcomes the challenge.
I think they would love to fly to Mexico. I think they'd love to fly to Hawaii one day. And I think this is kind of like a baby step for them to break out and become a major player.
And, he says, who knows which other companies Southwest might buy to accomplish those goals. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
President Obama was on NBC this morning. Matt Lauer had him on the Today Show for half an hour, talking for the most part about education. It's no surprise at all, though, that the conversation did turn to the economy and the job market as well.
As long as unemployment is as high as it is, as long as we haven't recovered as quickly as we should have, people are going to be hurting.
It's what he said after that, though, that caught our attention. That bad as things still are in the labor market, this country is not in a jobless recovery. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to track that one down for us.
As the president says, the private sector has been adding jobs since January, about 100,000 a month on average. We had to wait years for significant job growth after the recessions in 1990 and 2001. But those were mild recessions. We didn't lose 8 million jobs, and unemployment didn't get anywhere close to double digits. And economist Gary Bertlis at the Brookings Institution says, even though this isn't technically a jobless recovery, it sure feels like one.
The growth in the number of jobs every month is smaller than the growth in the working age population.
What that means is when you add in new high school and university grads and parents returning to work and people who got laid off and still can't find jobs, the labor market just isn't keeping up.
People like myself worry we're going to have very high unemployment for a very long time to come.
In fact, economists are divided about whether unemployment will ever get back down where it was before the recession, about 5%. That's what used to be considered normal. John Challenger at the outplacement firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas is convinced it will go back down eventually, but he says it may not look much like the old full employment.
Many more employers today
are utilizing people on a part-time basis as consultants.
Challenger thinks the trend is here to stay. He calls it just-in-time hiring.
They hire people on to handle their surges, but they don't turn them into permanent full-time employees.
Many economists believe the financial rescue and stimulus spending of the past 2 years have helped. They say without them, the economy might still be losing jobs today. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If everything works out right for him, Citigroup's hotshot new investment banker stands to get $30 million over the next 3 years. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. Stephen Trobner is Citigroup's highest profile hire since the bank got out from most of the government's executive compensation restrictions. It's a sign that Citi is back in the market for high-priced talent and that Wall Street salaries just might be heading back to where they were not so long ago. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Citi isn't confirming any details about its new hire, but it clearly marks a change for a bank that was badly weakened by the financial crisis. Jay Brown is a law professor at the University of Denver. He says the company's making up for lost time.
You know, one of the things that you see with this new hiring is that Citigroup is sort of shaking off the restrictions from the government, and it's becoming a more aggressive competitor in the marketplace.
The rules of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, a.k.a. TARP, gave the government a say in how much companies could pay their top executives. Citigroup paid back a big chunk of its government loan last year, but the Treasury still owns around 17% of Citi's shares. The government couldn't weigh in on this hire, but it still oversees bonus payments to top Citi executives. The government can only restrict pay at GM, Chrysler, AIG, and Ally Financial. But these days, it's mostly out of the executive compensation game. That means there's not much stopping banks from making big offers, just like they used to. Stephen Davidoff is a professor at the University of Connecticut's law school. He says we'll see more and more of it as the economy gets back to normal.
There'll be the same competition for talent and the same forces which drove up a banker pay over the last 10 years will act to do so again.
Citigroup's CEO has made this big offer to lure new talent, but for the last 2 years, he's only taken an annual salary of $1. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
September's been pretty good to Wall Street, except for today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Walmart may be the 800-pound retail gorilla, but like a lot of companies these days, it's having a hard time expanding in what's become a slow-growth world. With American consumers pretty much tapped, the company's going overseas again. Walmart is going to spend $4 billion to get a toehold in what may well be one of the fastest-growing markets left out there. Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
Walmart's in talks to buy South Africa's third-largest retailer, Massmart Holdings. The chain sounds a lot like the Walmart we know. It sells electronics, food, and general merchandise, and its strategy, keep prices as low as possible. U.S. shoppers have been hit hard by the recession, so Walmart's turned to emerging markets. And by some estimates, Africa's home to 1 billion potential customers. But analysts worry that the retail giant is spending too much to reach them, some $4 billion. Investment officer Walter Todd at Greenwood Capital says that's a high price to enter a market filled with economic and political risks of its own.
Any of these countries that have different laws and so forth are going to be have their own set of risks, and certainly that's there with this acquisition as well. But that's the trade-off that you're making for trying to enter these faster-growing markets.
But he says Walmart doesn't have much choice. The company has announced plans to open smaller formatted stores in the U.S., but the only place left for supercenters, maybe a new continent. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
If you wanted to pick one part of the banking industry that you'd bet your bottom dollar would be safe and prudent and not likely to do something silly with your money, a lot of people would probably say credit unions. And they'd be wrong. Last week, federal regulators took over three institutions that are what's called wholesale credit unions. They're basically credit unions for your local credit union. And they were shut down because they had plowed a bunch of money into bad investments. Can you say subprime mortgages? Eric Dash reports on banking for the New York Times. Eric, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
So I think of, and I think most people think of credit unions as being this sort of, college town or trade group or whatever sort of local small banking institution. But there is this whole other layer, right? Wholesale credit unions?
Right. Well, credit unions themselves have always held themselves out as the safest havens of the banking industry. They were the places that didn't make subprime loans. They shied away from commercial real estate. They were where you just sort of went and parked your cash. And as it turns out, that's true. And 99% of credit unions are just fine. But unfortunately, there was this extra layer there that serviced these credit unions. They provided things like payment processing and investment services to the retail credit unions, which are the places that you and I would go. And when the retail credit unions left their money at these wholesale credit unions, they reinvested it. And some of the things that they reinvested it turned out to be complex mortgages and subprime bonds. And when the market collapsed, so did those investments.
Is there taxpayer exposure on these things?
Taxpayers aren't expected to lose a penny on these things. The industry is going to pick up the cost, just sort of the way that FDIC insurance works. When a bank fails, it's the banking industry that pays for the cost of resolving that bank. And when a credit union fails, through a similar mechanism, the credit union industry will pay. It's probably going to cost the credit union industry anywhere between $7 and $9 billion, which is a lot of money.
Yeah, but if you're a credit union customer, you can safely expect to see $7 to $9 billion worth of fees tacked on, right? Because they're not going to take that out of their own pockets.
The industry is going to get hit with an assessment fee, and that may wind up getting passed on to consumers, but it's also a competitive industry, so it may, and also rates are very low right now, so it's hard to sort of predict where it's going to show up in the consumer experience.
Yeah. The thing that raised our eyebrows when we heard about this and read about the stories was the fact that mortgage-backed securities, these toxic assets, are still out there and they are still working their way through the financial system. We're not done yet.
Right. No, we're not. We're probably, if you talk to the experts, about halfway through the bad assets. And
so, all right, wait, say that again. Halfway through it, 2 years on.
2 years on. You know, there were probably at the height of the crisis, but I think something like $1.5 trillion worth of residential real estate and about $500 billion of commercial real estate. We're a lot further along on the residential side of things, but there's still a lot of commercial real estate. It's the shoe that hasn't yet dropped.
If we're halfway through, though, is the worst of it over? I mean, now that we know what's out there?
The way I look at this is this was sort of one of the last remaining hurdles for regulators. We had the big resolutions of, you know, companies like IndyMac and Washington Mutual. Then we had a wave of regional banks that were in trouble. We sort of took care of those. And then we've had about 279 or so smaller banks that needed to get resolved. I think that you're starting to see signs that the worst of the problem loans are starting to stabilize.
Eric Dash, he's a banking reporter for the New York Times. Eric, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Coming up, which came first, the undocumented worker or the job?
This year we have initiated over 2,600 investigations of employers, which is near triple the amount we were doing just 3-4 years ago.
But first, let's do the numbers. Mergers revved up airline and consumer product stock today, though the rare September rally did take a breather. The Dow Industrials fell 48 points, about 0.4%, closed at 10,812. The NASDAQ dropped 11 points, 0.4%, ended things at 2369. The S&P 500 slipped 6 points, 0.5%, finished at 1142. Financial shares fell on continuing worries about the strength of the recovery. Bank of America withdrew more than 2.5%. JPMorgan Chase lost about 1.75%. As we told you earlier, Southwest Airlines struck a deal to buy discount carrier AirTran. Both stocks then shot up. AirTran was the day's biggest gainer anywhere, soared 61%. Southwest flew up nearly 9%. Most of the other airlines rose in their wake, but Delta lost about 2.5% or so. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.53%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. By Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee looks at wage differences between men and women in management. It will specifically focus on the impact of motherhood on the wage gap. A House Financial Services subcommittee examines how terrorism is financed. And what do you think about the economy? The Conference Board releases its monthly consumer confidence survey on attitudes towards spending. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are a couple of things that, despite what we all thought at the time, just didn't happen as a result of the financial crisis. Wall Street is still Wall Street, even without Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. The economy is still there, if tempered by the credit squeeze in the recession. But our regular commentator Robert Reich argues in his new book, it's called Aftershock, that there's been something more fundamental at work to change the American economy the past couple of decades, more significant than just bank failures and global recessions. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Kai.
The standard answer, if someone were to ask how we got into this mess to begin with, would be some combination of the banks did this and real estate did that, and then it all went kerflooey. You, though, have a different thesis on this one, don't you?
Yes, I think the underlying structural problem is that consumers basically don't have the income. They don't have the purchasing power any longer. This is something that actually started about 30 years ago when wages started to level out and a lot of the economic gains went to the top.
If they are at the top then, Bob, how do you pry them loose? Because that is no mean feat.
Well, I don't think you have to pry them loose in the sense of kind of creating class war. I'm a class warrior, W-O-R-R-I-E-R, not a warrior. Yeah. I mean, look, one of two things is going to happen over the next 5 to 6 years. Either we are going to mobilize the kind of reform instincts we have and really have an economy in which the middle class and the lower middle class share a larger portion of prosperity and economic gains and therefore have the money to get the economy going again, or we are going to have a period of regression.
Yeah, but here's the thing. We had our whack, right? We had the chance to do financial reform. We had this once-in-a-generation crisis that shook us to our core, and yet your position is it hasn't done enough. So my question is, if it wasn't that, then how are we going to fix things?
Unlike the 1930s, the Great Depression, when we went into the Great Recession, when we actually saw things starting to fall apart, we knew enough and had learned enough from the Great Depression to do all of the things that they did not do in the 1930s and should have done in the 1930s to avoid the collapse. But the paradox is that by doing all of this, by avoiding that financial collapse, we, in a sense, avoided and took away the degree of political will, the kind of political pressure to do something more dramatic about income inequality that is really at the root of all of this.
You end, it must be said, optimistically. You point out the reservoir of resilience that the American population has, and you say that we have had these pendulum swings of concentration of wealth and then distribution of wealth throughout our history. Question for you, though, is if the economy is fundamentally different now, if this Great Recession changed everything, how do you know that that pendulum will continue to swing, and when it does, it will go back towards more equal distribution of wealth?
Well, because it always has in the past, and we don't really have much choice.
Yeah, but you know that Wall Street saying, right? Past performance is no indicator of future returns, Bob.
Yes, I don't think it's going to the pendulum doesn't swing in American history exactly to where it was before. I mean, right now, you've got about 23.5% of total national income going to the top 1%, when 30 years ago, about 9% of total national income is going to the top 1%. You just can't keep going in that direction without the economy, number one, suffering, but number two, there being a political reaction. American history tells us over and over again, that Americans, unlike many other cultures and societies, when the going gets hard, we put ideology aside, we roll up our sleeves, we figure out what needs to be done, and we do it. We did it in the Great Depression. We did it before that in the first decades of the 20th century and the progressive era. We're going to do it again.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a regular commentator on this broadcast, and he writes books, lots of them. The most recent one is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
One of the arguments that comes up when people start talking about illegal immigrants is that they're taking the jobs that American citizens would otherwise do. At least in agriculture, that argument just doesn't hold. The Associated Press has been running through some federal farm worker data. In California, for instance, just a couple of hundred people, citizens, 233 to be exact, have applied to fill more than 1,000 farm labor jobs since the beginning of the year. Since the Obama administration took office, it has changed the way the government goes looking for illegal immigrants. Instead of trying to track down the workers themselves, the feds go after companies now. The official line from Washington is that that reduces the supply of jobs that will attract undocumented workers to begin with. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
The government raids fewer factories to arrest undocumented workers. Now it scrutinizes more paperwork in what are known as silent raids. Basically, they're audits conducted by the feds through Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They snoop through computer files and study I-9 employment eligibility forms. When agents find problems, they notify the employer. It's then the employer's responsibility to fire workers using fake IDs. Brett Dreyer oversees the immigration agency's workplace enforcement.
This year we have initiated over 2,600 investigations of employers, which is near triple the amount we were doing just 3-4 years ago.
The agency has arrested 170 employers this year and issued more than $5 million in fines related to I-9 inspections. But Dreyer says the agency is selective about who it targets.
We want to go after the egregious employers who are hiring undocumented workers, making it a business practice to hire undocumented workers, making it a pattern of practice. That is our priority.
One of those alleged egregious employers is a chef in San Diego. Michelle Malico owns a restaurant and catering operation called The French Gourmet. He has more than 100 people on staff who cook up
from braised short ribs to wonderful filet mignon to fish with a macadamia nut.
The immigration agency alleges that Malico repeatedly hired people he knew were working in the country illegally. When he goes to court in November, Malico faces up to 30 years in prison, millions of dollars in fines, and the forfeiture of his business. Gene Iredale is his lawyer.
The government says that because the building was used and people worked inside the building is subject to forfeiture. What we say is that the forfeiture laws are being abused in this case, that they are designed to go after people who sell crack, not creme brulee.
He says his client made a good faith effort to follow what Iredale calls a confusing and sometimes contradictory law. He believes the government is using the case to send a message to the restaurant industry.
If you harshly and excessively punish one person, it will deter or frighten other people in that same position, and therefore the government gets more deterrence bang for its law enforcement buck.
The feds won't comment on an ongoing case, but Dreyer would say that, in general, the government wants to be seen as a partner, not an adversary.
The federal government can't go this alone. We have to partner with private industry, with the employers in our country.
Some business leaders contend the government isn't trying hard enough to be a good partner. In the construction industry, contractors fear they'll be held responsible for the hiring practices of subcontractors. Brian Termail is spokesman for the Associated General Contractors of America.
This administration tends to default to the assumption that businesses have done wrong, that if anything has happened, it's generally the business's fault.
Trade associations like his caution members to double-check their employment records. Immigration lawyers like Terry Olson in Chattanooga, Tennessee, help companies audit their paperwork. He charges $5,000 to $10,000 for the service. Olson argues it's better to be safe.
Managers and HR people are actually going off to jail now.
While employers maneuver to protect themselves, the big question remains: how effective is the policy in keeping illegal immigrants out of the workforce? Migration experts say they don't have hard numbers yet, but they say the audits are far more effective than the old strategy. Raids on factories are dramatic, they say, but audits find more people who are working illegally. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Email Marketing, providing small businesses and nonprofits with personal coaches to help them succeed. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note today, a small victory lap, if I might be allowed. I got some heat from listeners a couple of weeks ago when I stifled a yawn over the latest Apple announcement. I honestly don't even remember what it was that Steve Jobs was so excited to tell us about that day, but my observation that Apple is pretty much always rolling out something new and getting way too much coverage for it has been quantified and, oh, by the way, validated. The Pew Research Center for Excellence in Journalism actually did a study of this whole thing, came out today. Radio, television, web, newspapers, everything. Turns out Apple has gotten 15% of all the coverage devoted to technology news over the past year. So right about here, that's where I yawn again. And yes, I know I'm giving them more publicity now, but I am fighting the good fight, right? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 48 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ shed 11 points, almost 0.5%. The S&P 500 slipped 6 points, almost 0.6%. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this broadcast, looking for charity among Chinese billionaires. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.